You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Luciano Cassa. He is calling from Berkeley, California. Luciano, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Luciano, throughout this interview, I know we want to cue up a few things that you've been playing, but let's talk about what it is that you're working on at the moment so people get a sense of your how you approach your work.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so currently and for a couple of months, so up until January 3rd, I'm in residency in Montalvo, Villa Montalvo in the peninsula. So it's basically, I would say, maybe 15 minutes from Cupertino and Mountain View and basically Silicon Valley. But it doesn't have any techy feel, but in fact it's very pastoral and very green and beautiful. And it's an artist residency that existed for several decades in California, and were sort of an artist retreat, and there are all these different kind of artists, composers, and but also writers, poets, visual artists, and so on. So currently I'm there, and I'm working on my second opera, who had just been premiered in Bolzano, produced by the Festival Transart. And the reason why I'm working on it is because after the premiere, I've been left with about 75 hours of footage. And so right now the plan is to turn this footage into a film. Maybe I should also say a few things about this opera, to explain a little bit better what exactly.
Yeah, let's talk about the opera, and also if you're collaborating with other artists, a little bit about that process. But yeah, let's talk about that opera.
Okay, so the opera is based on one of the chapters from Marinetti and Filia's Futurist Cookbook, and it's a chapter that originally is titled Pranzo Transista, but the opera, so therefore, sort of translated from the Italian would be sort of like a radical lunch or something. Where in three pages, Marinetti, the founder of Futurism, working with Filia, theorized the idea of having a meal and prepare the meal, prepared to the actual moment of eating the meal by 2 days and a half of fasting. In the original chapter from the book, Marinetti theorized to have the guests, to be 11 guests, of which himself as a master of ceremonies, and then 10 more guests that are split in 5 men and 5 women, that all will fast for 2 days and a half in a villa that Prampolini, the futurist architect, would have designed, and preparing basically to a very sensual and multisensorial event, because that is always the case in all the futurist meal described in the futurist cookbook. So you're eating, but you're also experiencing tactile sensation, but touching certain specific items, while also scents are being sprayed about the room, and sound and noise are also part of the entire meal experience, and colors are projected and so on. So in order therefore to prepare to this, as I said, multisensorial experience, the idea is that the guests leave for 2 days and a half in some kind of restraint, and particularly fasting is to be observed. This is a very short chapter, and Marinetti, just like in many other of his writing, is probably thinking, the way that maybe a writer would. Not everything that you write about is meant to be actually staged. But I thought, what if one was to take Marinetti literally, and therefore what would happen if actually you are trying to stage this? And so immediately came the idea of creating an opera basically this way. And so I wrote a proposal for a festival in Transart, who already in 2010 invited me with my orchestra, Futurist Noise and Toners, and they enjoyed were working with me and asking me if I wanted to do another project based on futurist writing, and so came the idea of doing that. So instead of having this stage in a villa designed by Prampolini, they found a castle by a lake on the Dolomite. You know, this is the area of Italy, the region of Italy that is called Südtirol, that is bordering with Austria. So there's a pristine alpine lake and a late 1800 castle, sort of like neo-medieval. And so basically, I proceeded casting 10 characters. And then from there came the idea of how to construct the opera, an opera that would last by default, 65 hours. And so the idea was
that's kind of a fantastic project, right? I mean, you know, the length of that, and of course, the Futurist Cookbook is well known, and I think something that's very influential for a lot of artists, but that's quite an inspiration. So go on. Yeah, the idea was that it would last 65 hours based on those 2 days of fasting and then the eating. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And then the eating will be the sort of like sensorial climax of the entire project. So immediately, of course, when I begin to think about this, I had some concrete problems and questions that I pose to myself. If this is a theater spectacle, even an opera, and music is continuous, in any case, what would happen to the people that are fasting? And I should say, actually, since you mentioned that, the Futurist Cookbook is known, and many of the other chapters describe meals. There are recipes for both food and cocktails. And if you have ever participated to one of these, in any case, you know that there is a level of performance art already basically part of the book. And so my idea was, well, why don't I use this chapter that is particularly challenging and you know, complex to render, and I take
right, it because as I remember, some of the things are also impossible to eat or
yes,
almost impossible to make, right?
You remember correctly, because some of the ingredients are like bulbs or machine oil and so on. So they may be mixed with beautiful, raisin coming from North Africa,
Right.
Yeah, so it's very beautiful the way, in fact, this element sort of converge in the book. Now, with a chapter of this kind, is one of its kind. I mean, the other are basically meals. No, but this one is talking about an experience that really involved whoever is subject to for, more than the length of a meal. These are 3 days spent together in a place in preparation for this moment. And so I immediately was thought of a variety of literary tropes that for me are very important. One of them is the idea of that you can find, well, both in Boccaccio's Decamerone, but also in Maynard-style British mystery novel. So the idea that there's a group of guests that is stuck in a situation and basically separated from the outside world. Maybe they get snowed in, or, the communication, the phone line are interrupted and something happened, like in Gosford Park, there's a murder, but in the Boccaccio's Decamerone, they are confined inside the castle because outside there's the Black Plague. So this group of people had to remain inside and they cannot really go. So immediately set this tension between the interior and the exterior, the inside and the outside. So for me, it was very interesting. And based on this literary trope, typically what happens is that storytelling is kind of the best way of driving forward whatever experience of confinement. And so in Boccaccio's Decamerone, for example, the guests that are escaping from the Black Plague, and so they are confined in this castle, entertain each other telling stories. This is also, of course, Le Marquis de Sade, had borrowed or used this particular literary trope, but also could be, Arabian Nights, when Sherazade has to tell stories of the night to, delay this particular sentence and so on. And so I thought that if I bring 10 people plus myself in a castle for 3 days and we are not allowed to eat, literally we're fasting, what are we going to do? And so I basically wrote the opera based on what I thought could happen, and I had sessions of storytelling where each one tells a story to the group. And then there are moments where people can meditate. There are rehearsals, so must be probably the only opera in which some music gets rehearsed as part of the opera itself. So the aria in the second day is rehearsed at the end of the first day, and the choir event prior to the dinner is rehearsed by all the guests at the end of the second day, and so on. So there are rehearsals and, of course, musical events happening day and night, expeditions outside the castle on the first day, and then on the second day, guests, the 10 guests are even allowed to swim in the lake and take footage of what they do. But I should also say the very important thing about this work is that immediately when I taught, 11 guests fasting in confinement, entertaining, telling stories, going out but reentering in this confinement situation, to me also created a very interesting version somehow of the scenario that you find in some reality TV shows, particularly the, you know, Big Brother. And so I immediately thought of creating an opera that essentially is sort of borrowed from reality TV, but it's an experimental work. So uses element of reality TV, but it twists them to create a work that is experimental, the way that I guess in some way Robert Ashley did with, you know, television shows with Perfect Lives. That was in a way my ambition, and sort of the project came together like that. And I was able to work with a cast of people that were really extraordinary, in my opinion. And I should say, I make the decision of the casting together with the director of the festival, Peter Paul Kindrat. I had a clear idea that if storytelling was going to be the main motor for the 2 days and a half of fasting, so I needed to bring in people that have different lives. And so I couldn't cast 10 opera singers that all will have told me the same story. And so came the idea of inviting people from different professions. So I had astrophysicists from the University of Padua, a very accomplished skier, Karen Putzer. She is a skier that won several gold medals for Italy at the World Championship for skiing. And then I had an experimental dancer as part of the project, and then a physician, because we thought that fasting was part of it. Maybe having a doctor, medical doctor, as part of the group could have been a great idea. And then a director of photography, which is Peter Streetman, who is the director of photography for all Matti Barney's films. And I had worked with Peter before on a documentary where I was also featured. He was
the director of photography on all of Matthew Barney's films, which means the director of the cinematographer. He was
the director of photography for Cremaster Cycle, for Draw and Restraint Number 9, for the most recent River of Fundament, and even for the newest Barney film, which is being shot right now. I worked with Peter before. I really like his work. I really like the way he works with camera lenses and framing and all that. And so he was very a key figure, I would say, in deciding camera placement. And, you know, I had some ideas of what I wanted, but it's great to work with people like that. And I'm a composer. I'm not trained as a film director, but I love films, specifically, you know, certain kinds or over others, of course, like we all do. But I had some clear idea of what I wanted. I wanted, for example, a lot of close-ups and not so much of a group scene, and also bring the castle with these sort of dilapidated walls as like the 12 guests in some way. So there's a lot of like still life images.
How does this all come together? I mean, it seems, you know, almost biblical in proportions. You have this like 65 hours, you know, this cast telling stories that's unscripted, you know, which sounds kind of fantastic and almost as impossible as the Futurist Cookbook. How did it actually unfold, and how long was this opera for the viewers?
So the opera was offered on a 24/7 live streaming, which is something that, you know, I mean, I would say 10 years ago would have been very difficult to handle. But right now, I think we basically went through the, it could be done, and we did it. So there was a 24-hour live streaming, and there were mirrors of this from also Performa in New York City, who had, you know, the links for my opera in their, on their website. Performa is the organization that commissioned me, the Orchestra of Futurist Noise and Tones in 2009, which we brought in Transarts Festival in Bolzano in 2010. So it was a likely partner or a logical partner to contact for this one. And then the Museum of Modern Art in Bolzano did basically arrange fundamentally the streaming that then eventually could be seen from everywhere. And of course, time zone differences created situations in which, you know, if you were in California and were looking at what we were doing, it was night. But at night, things would happen. And I had specific performances that I would do with light and even sound in the middle of the night, but also I directed the people in the booth that were controlling the images, sound and images. We had about 25 cameras, I think, set up, plus several microphones in all the rooms of the castle, and I directed them to basically point their attention away from the castle and towards the surrounding nature during the night, because at night when the sun sets, the wood around and the lake around comes alive with all sort of animal species. So it's a concert of frogs and birds and crickets. So in some way, basically, when things weren't really moving or story weren't told in the middle of the night in the castle, we still have activities, and they were broadcasted. And so, yeah, that's how it worked, and it worked quite well, I must say. It's not certainly one of the things that you will necessarily watch from beginning to the end, of course, right? But, you know, in that
well,
way...
Well, it's actually physically impossible to watch it from the beginning to the end, right? If it's live streaming, we'd have to do a lot of stimulant to be able to stay awake that long.
Yeah, no, exactly. And for me, it was perfectly fine. I mean, the idea of testing that particular aspect was part of the project itself, you know, the idea that at any given point the audience could tune in or, you know, sign in and look and then watch what's happening and then move on to other things. It's there's a tradition, of course, of that kind of even operas in the 20th century. If you go and look, specific instruction being given to the audience at the Met when Einstein on the Beach was first performed there, it was the same thing. You know, of course, it wasn't as long, but the specific instruction by Robert Wilson and Philip Glass were, you know, if you want to take a break to smoke, you can, you know, get out and then return. And so in that spirit, I had constructed the opera in some ways, but yeah, and so now we have 75 hours of footage, which is an uninterrupted three-day broadcast, plus all the additional footage that has been taped by either the missions that some of the performers do going out and returning back in the castle, underwater beautiful images that were captured when some of us swim in the lake. And so there's a lot of footage, and now the goal would be to turn this opera into a film. And so one of the questions, of course, is how to do that, how long. It won't be, you know, 3 days is long. I'm thinking maybe 4 hours now, but yeah, so that's what I'm working on right now.
Well, that sounds very exciting, especially because of the footage that you got. You know, I'm sure much of it was beautiful, and there's an awful lot to work with there. And then a 4-hour film is something that's also watchable, just as, you know, Matthew Barney's films are, though they're long. It's possible to watch the whole cycle.
Yeah, no, exactly. And even River of Fundament, the most recent one by Barney and Bepler, that was 5 hours. And I, you know, I went to MoCA in Los Angeles and watched the entire thing, and I was very happy. There are intermissions, but that's fine. I mean, so I'm thinking that maybe the format of 4 hours could work. One thing I should say is that even keeping the structure, but then trimming things, the structure of the opera as it was, and that's how I'm working right now, it could be useful because there's some kind of alternation between group moments where everybody is telling a story and a group responds and there's a, you know, followed Q&A after the stories. But then there are sort of solo moments, which are what I decided to do, are do film portraits of all the characters, including myself. So there are 11 film portraits, and each one lasts 33 minutes. And the camera is pointed directly to the face, and there's no, the instruction is that the person is not supposed to say anything. So the character, and so they're pretty stark, and everyone reacted differently to this kind of powerful, like, pointing of the camera towards your face or a part of it, because there's a lot of extreme close-ups as well. And so those one function a little bit like solo arias, whereas the storytelling section are choirs. That this were in my mind. And so I think between solos and groups moment and solos and group moment, that's how the dramatic form of the piece it was articulated in the original live streaming. And I want to sort of keep that format, maybe, of course, streaming it or, you know, shortening it, but keeping that sort of aspect in the final film.
Now, that seems like it's also something, but before we move on to the next project, which is the Pasolini, I just want to ask about how this was funded, because it sounds like a huge project. It is a huge project. There's all these people working on it. You know, the footage, the camera, the technical aspect. Did TransArt fund everything? I mean, typically operas are very difficult to fund because of the cost and the size of it. And yours seems like no exception, except for the fact that it didn't have to be staged live. Did TransArt fund the whole thing, or was there multiple funders? How does something like this get funded?
Yeah, no, it was funded by TransArt, and they had partners there, and local partners, including the Museum of Modern Art in Bolzano. And, yeah, in some ways, I mean, it probably costed as much as an opera production for a contemporary opera would have costed, except that the money was spent differently. Our staff of technicians were at least 10. I mean, it was just the technician plus, you know, the assistant, the technical assistant, the press office, and all that, and then the people flying from different parts of the world. Peter came from California, and so on. I mean, it's the 11 characters, all, each one came from a different place, some from Vienna and some from Berlin. So, yeah, I mean, it was an expensive production for being an opera, which it was, but, again, was conceived differently. I think we were lucky because the director of the festival, Peter Paul, is also works or runs a local TV, so he knew already people that worked on the television format. And in fact, people that work, the technician, had worked in a version of sort of Big Brother like program for the Italian TV, so he knew pretty much how certain things get handled in reality TV. And that I found it was very useful. And then one other had a drone with a camera, so I could bring in this sort of also futurist element of sort of aerial footage, which is already in the aeropittura of the 30s. My idea was that the first day was mostly the interior of the castle, the second day was the missions in the wood, and the third day, right before the climax with the actual food arriving and working with the chef, by the way, was opening up even more to even the skies. And so we had this drone images that are actually quite beautiful. I've seen some of them and came quite well. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't easy to put it together. I've been working on TransArt since 2011 on this idea. How are we making this happen and when and with whom? And now, of course, if it's going to be turned into a film, I will have, from this point on, I think to seek for funders and sponsors to create the film, so to do the editing and so on. So that's a part that I had, but we have all the materials now.
Right. So, but that's of course another project altogether. which could be easily as equally as ambitious. So I want to talk a little bit about Pasolini before we go, and I'd love to play a little bit from that. Can you tell us a little bit about Pasolini and that project? Because I know I want to play. I think we're going to cue up Carpe and another piece from that. So maybe you could introduce that and explain a little bit about what that was and what we're about to listen to.
Okay, so I'll start with Petroleum then. No, the piece for piano percussion.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about
okay.
that.
Yeah. So Petroleum, it's a piece for piano percussion that was commissioned to me by the Nuovi Spazi Sonori Festival in Rome. Performances that take place at the American Academy. And two performers from the Bay Area, Sarah Cahill, pianist, and Christopher Fro, percussionist, went to Rome. I went with them. And this was back in 2004, and I wrote this piece for them. My idea was to create, to basically write in some kind of rhapsodic way, musically speaking, about Pasolini's last and finished novel called Petroleum, which would be Petroleum or Oil. Therefore didn't set specific passages of the book into the piece, but it was mostly like thinking, zooming out of the book and then making a list for myself of a series of feelings or archetypal situations that the book is bringing forth. Pain, for example, is one element that is certainly there in it. Another element perhaps is, maybe even just as important as alienation, which is another aspect that I find, but also the incredible dialogue that the book presents between characters that in fact even change gender through the course of the story, particularly Carlo is the main character that at some point flips gender. For a book written in 1974, unfinished, but it was quite intriguing, I would say. And also another aspect of the book that I did there's a lot of questions around it, whether it's the case or not, but some people argue that probably costed Pasolini his life is that in Petroleum there's a quite clear sketch of the Italian political corruption of the time when he's writing, so the early 70s. And I think what was surprising back then is that in certain cases he would even name politicians directly by name, even in the fiction of the novel. We don't know in the finished version he would have replaced his names of, Fanfani or Andreotti, which are prominent Italian politicians. Andreotti was, and Fanfani as well, were prime ministers. So we don't know if he would have replaced with other fictional names, but in the manuscript, they are name by name. And, the accusation that certain section of the book brings forth are pretty tremendous. And for me, that moment, the one that Italian called Anni di Piombo, the mid-70s, the time of the Red Brigade, the time of a lot of, terrorist attacks in train stations and so on, plus the decade of the 70s, and I think culminating on the terrorist strike of the Bologna's train station, were all things that I absorbed from the news, but I was basically a teenager. I'm from, in 1980, I was 9 years old. So not even a teenager. I mean, when Moro was assassinated, I was, 5 years old. I mean, but at the same time, the news were constantly on. My mom and dad were watching them. The television was feeding these images and showing the thing. And so it remains with you, I suppose, this sense of fear, even coming from the TV that, the terrorists are out to get us or something. So I always tried in retrospect to understand more about that specific time in history of my country. And reading Petrolio or what remains of it was just one more way or opportunities for me to research that specific time juncture. And so this piece is a meditation about that. So really filtered through also my early childhood memories as well.
And so when the first piece that we're about to cue up, that was part of this, that was coming from this, and should you say anything more about that before we cue it up? This is what we're about to listen to is Petrolio.
So,
from,
so Petrolio is divided in four movements, no? But the division is entirely musical, so it's not that each one has a specific content or is about anything in particular. But maybe I would say for me it's a very important piece because it's one of the first piece in which I attempted to do something that eventually I applied to larger scale composition and even my first opera, the one called A Heavenly Act, where I use very recognizable melodic elements, but then I immersed them in noise or in entirely foreign background. So the piece Petrolio opens with a very distinguishable melody, but eventually sank in this sort of, again, like noisy environment to the point that it disappears. So Petrolio was the first attempt of working with that, the idea of writing melodies so that I can destroy them in some way, or can the way that you would if you bathe into acid, you know, organic matter.
I like that. Okay, so let's listen to that. We're queuing up Petrolio from Pasolini. Thank you, Luciano. That was Petrolio. So to talk a little bit about that, you've introduced it. That was a piano and percussion duet. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah. It was a piano percussion duet. So everything you hear in this piece in all four movements, it's only an exclusively play with no sounds processing by a piano and a very simple percussion setup with a tam-tam, primarily like a tam-tam, and then a bow flexotone in the second movement, and then a snare drum. So it's very, very simple. And there's no mallet instrument being used. And so, yeah.
Well, that's exciting to hear. It seems a kind of, in a way, a minimalist way to produce or to compose, but it's also, as you say, kind of deteriorates or moves into something like an almost collage of sounds. Does that seem appropriate to say?
Yeah, and I would say particularly the first movement of Petrolio, that becomes really, really clear because, as I said, that first theme that then eventually translated in the piece in the third movement as well, it essentially very gracefully within the arc of maybe a minute and a half to 2 minutes collapses into this resonance that is produced with the tam-tam, and then the movement ends with this kind of very gentle, I would say, cliffhanger. And I think working with melodies is good because if you paint a piece with noise against noise, it's in my opinion, it's harder to shape any kind of form. But if you create, any set against each other, a melodically recognizable tune with even pure white noise, then that is very dramatic to me. And I can construct a dramatic form out of that. And the idea also of the melodic, it's important for me because you don't understand Pasolini if you don't get this clear sense of this Italian intellectual active in the time that he was, in a time in which basically felt and looked nostalgically at the Italian rural culture that will be essentially will vanish or will be destroyed, will melt into the acid of the industrialization. No, Pasolini is all about this moment of nostalgia, about these voices of farmers that he, of course, romanticized. In part because he feels like, well, this is the end of an era that maybe started with Homer or Virgil, but then this is it. Globalization will come in and this will become completely eroded and destroyed. No? And so there's an element of nostalgia for this kind of folk culture that is in Pasolini and certainly is in Petrolio in my piece. You know, that the tune that I wrote, which I wrote, is not borrowed by a folk tune, but I was written kind of writing something that my mother would hum. A melody that she could hum, and thinking about her voice, and so I hope that this offer a further explanation of why the piece moves the way that it does. So I
it does it does. That makes it clear that to have that kind of contrast of melody and everything else you're talking about, I agree that lends a kind of structure to it. So so you can move into all these other areas that you've been discussing, and also something very kind of intimate that can be memorable in a melody. The way, as you're saying, a mother can hum a melody, not even consciously knowing what she's doing, perhaps, but because it's so memorable and it is such a distinctive structure. I would like to also play another piece, Carpe, which is also from Pasolini, as I understand. Can you tell us a little bit about what we're about to hear with Carpe and what role that played?
Yeah, I should clarify. So it's Carpe is a song that I wrote in 1991, and it's now part of the same record called Petrolio, but it doesn't have a relationship with Pasolini. It just happens to be in part of this record on Stradivarius where Petrolio is featured. And because it's a prominent piece and the piece is up on the record, I named the record Petrolio. But aside from the four movements of Petrolio, the rest of the material are different compositions. So Carpe is part of a four songs that I had written when I was a student in composition in Bologna at the conservatory, so in the early 90s. And one of the assignments from my professor was to write the so-called free composition, which for conservatories at the time in Italy, free composition meant write in some kind of modernist style, maybe write like Nono or, you know, Berio would have write. And always seemed strange to me back then that it was called free. And so my idea was, well, why don't I write something that I really feel is free? And so at the same time, I became interested in popular music. And it was I was a relatively late bloomer, meaning that I got finally interested in popular music when I was 17 and 18 years old, when I grew up with more like classical and even experimental music earlier in, more when I was 12 or 13 years old. So, and as soon as I discovered, you know, the world of, say, indie rock, I immediately thought to form a band. And so there I was, and I was writing some of the songs. And so my idea was, why don't I make...
Let me just interrupt you this. So that was your introduction to music. I mean, you've mentioned your parents a little bit, but it sounds like your parents weren't musicians, but as you came to music in the way you just explained, through a variety of things, and as a teenager, getting into indie rock and forming a band, or were there other influences? Like, were your parents musicians or...
They were not professional musicians, neither of them. My father would play guitar, and, you know, I'm originally from Sardinia, so my father and mother will hum, like, you know, other members of my family, traditional Sardinian folk tunes. And I guess that those, and maybe classical music, which was also my father's favorite opera, were the first thing that I heard. So basically Verdi, Mendelssohn, Beethoven, and then Mussorgsky, you know, were among the earliest things that I remember. And then starting to study piano, of course, the pieces in the repertoire, Bach, and so on.
So the Mussorgsky you initially heard, was that Pictures at an Exhibition? Is that what you were hearing?
Yeah. Very much so. So which eventually, when I graduated in piano, was one of my graduation pieces. So I performed Picture at an Exhibition, and then, you know, Schumann's Opus 17, the Fantasy, and all that. So so those were sort of like my love earlier on as a musician, when I decided to become a musician. But then, becoming a teenager, I discovered other things, like, I don't know, Pixies and Sex Pistols, and, you know, and Joy Division, and so on. But that... And that was quite a shock, because I was a student of the conservatory, and we were not supposed, I suppose, to listen to this repertoire. But, I mean, of course, everybody did, and the professors as well. But just to say that, you know, maybe some people first discover popular music, and then they want to, you know, join the conservatory and know more. In my case, I was, my first piano teacher, and at that point I was maybe 11 years old, knew John Cage personally, and had some kind of exchange with him at some point, and played a lot of Cage's music. So my exposure to that world came before even discovering indie rock. But then when I did, I guess, represented the rebellion that he did, and I, in some way, applied some of these ideas to my music, the music that I was writing. I was thinking, well, why shouldn't I? And so once I wrote a song called Carpe for my band, and I recorded it, and then I thought, maybe I can make a version for a string trio, piano, and percussion of this piece and see exactly what turns out to be, you know, and trying to pass it for a modern lead. And my composition professor wasn't too fond of it, and so he actually... some of these songs that I transcribed for the standard chamber ensemble and voice were never performed. But then years later, I decided I still have the score, I want to hear them. And so I played them, and I thought they were nice. And so I recorded some of them, and Carpe is one of them. And Carpe, I should say this much maybe, is my attempt of creating a piece that has a tuneful line, but then there's a layer of distortion over it. I guess maybe my music is always about the same thing. Except that in this particular piece, it's not so much that the distortion increases and the melody disappears, but they both, in a very clear conflictual way coexist for the entire duration of the piece. Now, and that idea was actually not mine, but was part of some of the earliest records that I fell in love with, which was Jesus and Mary Chain's Psycho Candy, where exactly the same happened. You know, the brother Reeds are singing very, very sticky, sweetie tunes over this layer, giant roar of, you know, guitar oversaturated, creating almost a white noise environment. And the friction between the two, I always thought, was very successful. And so that was sort of my response to that. And so in this particular piece, you hear the piano and the voices that are pretty much, you know, singing the tune, but then very clearly in many, many moments, the string trio sometimes joins the piano playing, the harmonizing what the voice is singing, but sometimes they create, in fact, this essentially layer, very, very recognizable layer of hissing or white noisy soundscape that it's, you know, very much what the piece is about.
So let's cue that up and talk a little bit about it. We're about to listen to Carpe.
In un lago non distante, che l'inverno non si ghiaccia, vide pullulano fredde, venne calde gelatine, venne calde gelatine. Gli occhi fissi ma espressivi, dai nervosi movimenti, lancian per la lente d'acqua, sguardi ci sognanti, sguardi ci sognanti. Vite pullulano fredde, verdi calde gelatine, verdi calde gelatine, verdi calde gelatine, verdi calde gelatine, verdi calde gelatine. Che l'inverno non si ghiaccia, occhi fissi ma espressivi, lanciano per la lente d'acqua, sguardi ci sognanti, molluschi, molli, affusi, attratti, sovraccitati,
Luciano, that was a very interesting piece. And was that, was what we just heard, Carpe, that was performed at the American Academy in Rome?
No, only Petrolio was. So Carpe was first performed when I finally make the new version with students of the conservatory for a festival in San Francisco as part of the conservatory where I teach, you know, as part of the San Francisco Conservatory musical concerts, I mean, series of concerts. And so, yeah.
And so what is it like to listen to that now? So, I mean, you know, I've never heard anything quite like that. When you hear this now, as after we've just played it, does that still remind you of the beginnings of all of that, or does it have a different feeling for you now?
So I listen to the piece even when I record it, because what happened is I dig the score, I ask some of my students if they want to try it, and they did, and we did it live to this concert and in another occasion, and then we went to the studio to record the full record, Petrolio, and I decided to include that. So when I finally recorded that, I really... I mean, I was kind of moved, because it's a piece that I had written in 1991, and I ended up recording it in 2014, I think, you know, so several years later. And for me, was in any case some kind of confirmation that what I was interested in, it is still somehow what I'm interested in now. So as I was joking before, I said, maybe I'm writing about the same thing over and over, but, you know, making, of course, adjustments. But that kind of soundscape to me is still as fascinating as it was back then, with the difference that back then I only envisioned that in my head. I played the song with the group, but, of course, the layer of distortion was done with the electric guitar, the way the Jesus and Mary Chains achieved it. But it got a very different grain with the violin, but I had an idea of what I was doing with the violin, but it was never performed. So it was in some way some kind of confirmation.
That's exciting. I mean, I'm glad you shared those with us and we got to play that. Before we move on to the last question, it's been great talking to you about all of this. Is there anything else we should say about these pieces? I think it was wonderful to talk about the opera and Marinetti's book, and this gives us a good sense of your work. Is there anything else that I've missed or we should mention before I ask the last question?
Well, yeah, I think maybe one important aspect that is not probably even discussable, if there is a word of that kind, in the context of a radio program, is that most of the work that I do involve very relevant visuals. Which I try to stay away from the dullness of, like, oh, let me project a film track against you playing, but rather, you know, the way the players are dressed or the lights. Lights are very important for me. And in the past maybe 5 years, I'm working on live presentation of my music at a very, very intense live choices. All the players, I mean, ideally the entire performance space is in complete darkness and only very powerful flashlight has beams that just strikes against certain key aspects of the space. Can be a detail of the hand or the face of the performer, something. So that's just one of the examples, but I mean, in other words, I really work a lot with theater elements, with props as well. So I guess the listener can check and look at my Variazioni su un oggetto di scena on YouTube. There is a piece that I perform on a piano, but guiding the hands of teddy bears and other stuffed animals and dolls. And so, of course, if you hear a recording of that piece but you don't see exactly what's happening, and also if you don't commit to watch the entire 7 minutes of the piece, you're not going to get... You're not going to, I don't think, enter into the piece at all. So in the case of Petrolio, I think it's different, but in most of my music recently, now even more so than before, as I mentioned, the past five years, even more so, it's going in the direction of using a lot of elements other than just pure sound.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, and of course there'll be links in the interview for the listeners to also look at the video you just mentioned and perhaps others. Luciano, before we go, I want to ask the question that I've asked everybody at the end, which is, can you tell me what books you're reading now, or book, if you are? Always interested in what people are reading.
Yeah, so, well, I'm reading right now a very beautiful pamphlet by a friend of mine, Nicola, who was actually one of the guests one of the guests of my opera. He's a philosopher and teaches at the University of Cuneo, Nicola Perullo, that published a couple of books that are not, that are about food and wine, but they're not what you would expect. They're not, certainly the book about food, they're not cookbook, but they're also not about all food is an art. But he, being a philosopher, for example, published this pamphlet that I'm reading right now that is called Epistemologia, so which will be translated epistemology, which is, of course, a pun between enology, which is the science of, you know, creating wine, and epistemology. So, which is a book in which he moves from wine, trying to use wine as a way of accessing a very specific kind of place of philosophical thought. So it, as he likes to put it, is not a book about wine or the philosophy of wine, but it's a philosophy with wine, which doesn't mean a drunk philosophy either, but it's something else altogether. And it's even hard to explain exactly what it is, but it's a, you know, only 100 pages, and it's definitely a great reading. And he's book on food has actually just been printed, and he's translated into English. I believe it's Columbia University Press. I can, you know, look. Anyway, Nicola Perullo, which was originally published by the Slow Food Movement in Italy, and then the English translation came up a couple of months ago. And again, it's a book. It's not philosophy of food, but it's philosophy with food, if it makes sense.
As well, I'll have to read that. Thank you, Luciano, for that. That sounds very interesting, and I want to thank you also for taking the time to do this interview with me.
Oh, sure. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.